The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have one bill today, a Hillstrom bill, and then we'll have an overview of the Office of Justice programs and some presentations on youth intervention programs. So, Representative Hillstrom, do you want to present your bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, do you know who wants to see this next? There's a long line, I think.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, why don't you first move your bill and move your amendment so we can get it in the shape that you like, and then we can... I don't know, actually, where does this... Does it go to Judiciary from here?
Mr. Chair, I think Health needs to see it first because it's...
okay.
Mr. Chair, the Health Committee would like to see this, Health Finance, I assume.
Okay, so do you want to move your bill and get that referral language together, and then we'll do your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 40 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Health Finance Committee.
Okay, and then do you want to... why don't you just move your amendment, and then we can talk about that, too.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I would move the A13 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it.
Okay. So Representative Hillstrom moves the A13 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Hillstrom, you want to explain the bill and the amendment?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. What this bill does is it increases the background checks that currently happen when a guardian or conservator applies to the court to be a guardian or conservator. Currently, background checks are done, but that doesn't include professional licenses. And so this bill would require that the background check include professional licenses in Minnesota and in other states, if there is a fiduciary responsibility that the person has had with their professional license previously. So with me is Mr. Voigt from the Attorney General's office. He's first going to talk through the issue and the solution, and then I also have County Attorney Tony Palumbo.
Before we do that, Representative Hillstrom, do you want to just, explain to us what we just voted on with the amendment?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. So we're making some clarifications for those folks that do the background checks about what kinds of licensing they need to check and about how many days in which they need to turn that information around. That is getting us closer to what the department would like. Mr. Chair, the language isn't specifically perfect just yet, but we continue to work. Mr. Chair, it is our intention that whatever it costs to do these background checks, we are going to pay for with the fee. Currently, this bill raises a $2 fee to include the background checks. It's my understanding from the department that that may only cover the in-state background check fee, and to do the background check on the out-of-state, there may have to be an additional fee, but when we get the fiscal note for that bill, we'll know. But it isn't this committee. It's the Health Committee area that would take care of that.
Representative Hillstrom, just to clarify, because maybe we didn't need to make this stop, I'm not sure, but it says on page one of the bill that you're using systems criminal history data from the BCA. So are you saying there's not a cost to the BCA?
Mr. Chair, we currently do those background checks already, and there's currently already a cost. So this is not an additional cost to the BCA. The checks that would add the increased cost are about the professional licenses. So we'll be checking with the professional licensing boards for that additional data.
Okay. You want to have your testifiers?
Certainly. Mr. Voigt, you state your name for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Voigt. I'm a Deputy Attorney General.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The idea behind this bill is to get better and more current information to the district court judges that appoint these guardians and conservators. The people who require the protection of guardians and conservators are vulnerable adults and aren't able to do things like manage their own finances, and so it's critically important that the people that are appointed to do that are qualified to do so. Currently, we have background checks that check criminal history every 5 years. And what this bill aims to do is to expand that to get more information and to get information to the courts more often, every 2 years rather than every 5 years. In addition to the criminal history information, it would provide district court judges with other indicators that are highly relevant to a person's qualifications to manage somebody else's money. Things like whether they've had civil judgments against them, whether they've gone through the bankruptcy process, and whether they've held professional licenses or have been disciplined in their professions. And we're not talking about all of the licensing boards here. We're talking about only the licensing boards that have duties relevant to those of a professional fiduciary. So we're not talking about barbers, cosmetologists. We're not talking about commercial driver's licenses. We're talking about things like accountants, professions like attorneys, professions that have duties that are at least related to the duties of a fiduciary. From the Attorney General's perspective, the impetus for this bill was a case that we prosecuted in Rice County that involved a professional fiduciary by the name of Terry Haugie. She had a company called Estate Resources, and in the 1990s, she had been an attorney, and she was disciplined by the Lawyers Board for mishandling cases and for lying to clients. And rather than getting her attorney license reinstated, she switched professions and formed a company called Estate Resources, and she was essentially a professional guardian and conservator. She got appointed to cases in Hennepin County and Dakota County and Rice County, and had one of the largest companies in the state that provided those services. But the judges who appointed her never knew about that discipline as an attorney. And ultimately, she stole money from a lot of clients, drained their finances. And we're talking about people who live on less than $1,000 a year, usually. And we find that she stole a lot of money from a lot of people. And it not only depleted their resources, it left some of them in very dangerous situations. In one case, after she was removed as a guardian, social services found her client living in an absolutely squalid apartment with no food to eat. In another case, one of her clients was released from emergency medical care in a town that he wasn't familiar with, and she refused to provide him access to his money, leaving him in a motel room with no money and no food. And really, this bill is about trying to screen out people that maybe shouldn't be appointed in the first place. You know, in the case of Ms. Haugie, maybe if the courts who appointed her knew about this professional discipline, they would have had second thoughts about appointing her in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Voigt? Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, sorry. Mr. Voigt, and I'm trying to get through this, but I haven't completed. It looks to me like this is, what I'm worried about is this state is going crazy on collateral consequences and things like that. And a lot of things in here certainly shouldn't affect somebody had a bankruptcy, they may have a medical thing. This just notifies the judge so it doesn't in any way prevent that judge from taking into consideration and still appointing them, right?
Precisely. This doesn't disqualify anyone. It just simply provides the information to the judge who's making the decision.
That was Mr. Voigt. Sorry. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question here. Looking here on the sheet, we're looking at, I believe it's the amendment here, at 116. I mean, it actually starts on 15. If the proposed guardian or conservator has resided in a state other than Minnesota in the previous 10 years, the licensing agency data shall also include the licensing agency data from other state or states where the proposed guardian or conservator resided. What's the plan if you can't get that data from other states? Would that be a roadblock, or would that interfere and slow the process down? How does that work,
Mr. Voigt?
Mr. Chair, our expectation is the Department of Human Services would do their best to get that data, and I believe part of the application process to become a guardian would be to sign releases for that information. So we expect that if they have signed releases, they will be able to get data from other states.
Representative Neuberger. Any other questions for Mr. Voigt? Before your next testifier, Representative Hillstrom, so the BCA is going to examine the bill to determine if there's any fiscal cost to them at all, and if there is, they will inform MMB, and they will be part of the fiscal note. So Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, it is my intention to pay for whatever costs incurred through the increase in the fee for the background check, I have no doubt that it will be neutral.
Okay, very good. And your next testifier?
Mr. Chair, this is Anoka County Attorney Tony Palumbo has been working with us on this bill.
County Attorney Palumbo, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, Tony Palumbo, P-A-L-U-M-B-O. And I am here, of course, to support the bill from a local perspective. I agree with Mr. Boyd from the Attorney General's office. This certainly does provide background information, very helpful background information that could help a court make a better decision. And in the prosecution community, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are finding an increase in financial exploitation of adults later in life. I think this is just simply because of the demographics. People are living a lot longer. They have the middle class certainly has accumulated more wealth than they have in previous generations, and that wealth now is in the hands of people who are now becoming vulnerable many times, not just because of their age, but because of diseases or other conditions. And when that happens, unfortunately, there are those out there that might take advantage of that. We have started a program in Anoka County called SAFE, which is Stop Abuse and Financial Exploitation. And we've done it in collaboration with public and private agencies. And prior to starting this in the previous 10 years, we've had 2 referrals. Since we started the program 18 months ago, we've had 26. And they have been mainly financial exploitation type of cases of adults later in life. This bill would expand the background information that is required to be checked, especially if a guardian has lost a professional license, which I think would be significant to a court in making his decision as to whether to appoint. A court certainly would want this information that is provided for in this bill to make its best decision. In my discussion with judges, they always want information. I'm sure those of us that are lawyers that have been in front of a court, court always wants to make the best and fair decision. This bill will certainly help a court do so. You know, at the outset, I should say that many, many guardians and conservatives are very good and they are very honorable. I don't want the bill to suggest that they are not. What we are talking about is this bill would help screen out those that are not so honorable, as demonstrated by their previous conduct. For example, any loss of professional license, any fraud, judgments, that kind of thing, as court certainly would want to take those into account. You know, the estate of a ward may be too great a temptation for someone in this position who needs money, and that's why the background information is, I think, extremely helpful. This bill will be very helpful in addressing what we see as an emerging and a growing area of concern for prosecutors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to this bill, or anyone else that wants to speak on behalf of this bill? Anything? Closing remarks, Representative Hillstrom. Otherwise, you want to renew your motion?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Just one quick closing comment. Members, the Government Accountability Office did a study of 45 states, and they looked between 1990 and 2010 at some closed cases. And they found that out of the 20 cases that they selected,
guardians stole approximately $5.4 million from 158 incapacitated victims. This is a real issue, and I encourage members to support the bill. This is one step that we can take to make certain that the court has the information they need to protect vulnerable adults.
Very good. Any questions? You want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 40, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Health Finance Committee.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you for testifying on the bill. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. If someone would indulge me and make a motion to approve the minutes of January 29th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal makes that motion. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Okay, so members, I hope you, we've been trying to put together these, for the hearings, these overviews of areas that come under our budget. So I hope these have been helpful, whether it's on sexual violence or whatever, you know, a number of issues that we've taken up, because all of those issues we will be visiting in greater detail. And one area of the Department of Public Safety budget is the Office of Justice Programs. So I thought this would be a good idea to get an overview of what OJP does. And we won't talk about the budget today. And then we have a couple of programs that OJP funds that would like to make a presentation to the committee. So with that, I would ask Jerry Beauvair, who is... been the head of OJP for many, many years, to at least as long as I think I've been here. So if you, Jerry, Ms. Beauvair, if you would give a brief overview, because we have some new members here who may not know what OJP does.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Beauvair, and I am the director for a very long time of the Office of Justice Programs. Thank you for this opportunity to provide a brief overview of the Office of Justice Programs and to share some of our successes, trends, and challenges. I do intend to be brief because I really would like to allow ample time for you to hear from the youth programs that are here in attendance. The history of OJP: we were created in 2003. Programs from five different state agencies were pulled together into one office to better coordinate criminal and juvenile justice planning activities as well as grant activities. Our mission is to provide leadership and resources to improve public safety, the functioning of the criminal and juvenile justice system, and to serve victims of crime. We do this by awarding state and federal grants to state, tribal, and local entities for critical public safety programming, by providing information, training, and technical assistance, conducting targeted research and evaluation, investigating violations of crime victim rights, providing assistance navigating the criminal justice system, and by reimbursing victims of crime, of a violent crime, for costs incurred due to that crime. OJP works closely with state, tribal, local, and criminal justice partners and community partners to improve justice outcomes. A few examples of these fruitful collaborations include our work with the Minnesota Criminal Justice Collaborative on Domestic Violence. This is a work group comprised of chiefs, sheriffs, county attorneys association, tribes, courts, and the BCA, ably led by the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, to improve policy and practices in serving victims of domestic violence. As a result of their work together, OJP was able to apply for a grant and receive that grant to replace the court's aging Order for Protection database. This new database will greatly enhance law enforcement's efforts to keep victims safe, and this is just one of the outcomes from this effective work group. Another example is OJP originally funded the development of VINE, or Victim Information and Notification, every day with federal funds. When those funds were eliminated or reduced, the legislature appropriated funds to continue to maintain this vital victim service. Staff from the Crime Victim Justice Unit was able to apply for several successive enhancement grants, which culminated in the most recent grant with our partners, the Department of Corrections, to develop the Minnesota Choice System, which they highlighted here last week as one of their efficiencies. Victims can now get real-time information on custody status of offenders from 91% of the state's counties and detention facilities and all of the Department of Corrections facilities as well. Well, JP currently has 36 full-time staff, and given the small size and the scope of our work, we do have to work across our teams to have success. I'd like to highlight just a few of the successes, trends, and challenges from the perspectives of those teams. Our reparations team, which is guided by the Reparations Board, provides reimbursement to victims and their providers for costs incurred to a violent crime. They play a vital role in the victim's recovery, both physically and psychologically. Claims have remained fairly stable over the last several years. We have noted an increase in the number of claims for violent robberies. Domestic violence and sexual assault claims remain quite high, and they're about 50% of the claims each year. There's sadly been a national trend to encourage local compensation programs to increase their ability to respond to mass casualty events. Because our team had responded sadly to the Red Lake tragedy, they were experienced in responding, and because of the processes they put in place, they were able to work closely with the Minneapolis Police Department and get applications to the families and all the victims from the accident signage tragedy very quickly, and victims got help timely and the kind of help they needed. A challenge they're facing is that compensation programs across the country are actually trying to grapple with what's the impact of health care reform on compensation programs, and everyone is grappling with this issue, so hopefully we'll have more to report to you later. The Crime Victim Justice Unit, which investigates violation of crime victim rights and assists people navigating the criminal justice system, has logged over 1,400 contacts each year for the last 5 years. A trend they have noticed and noted is an increase in the complaints they're getting about financial crimes, identity theft, fraud, and elder exploitation, and the lack of training and resources for victims at all levels. And they anticipate an increase in this area given the demographics. Annual reports for both these teams are on our website, and we had a four-page overview that was provided to, I think, last week. And our website is on the bottom of that four-pager. I hope you still have that. And it provides significantly more information about the activities in OJP. We have two grant teams, the Crime Victim and the Justice and Community Grants Team. Together, they administered about $62 million in state and federal grant funds last year to 300 state, local, and tribal governments and nonprofits. The Crime Victims Grant Team combined four federal grant funds as well as the state funds to support direct services around the state for victims of domestic and sexual violence, general crime, and child abuse. The Justice and Community Grants Team administers six federal grant programs and four state-funded initiatives. I think we've provided you with an overview, at least of the youth programs for today's conversation. The biggest trends, I think, facing, obviously, the Grants Division is declining resources. We have had depleting resources both at the state and the federal level. Our federal funds, some of our largest programs that we've had for years, have been decreased by about 42% to 50%, the Burn Justice Assistance Grant Program, as well as the Juvenile Justice Grant Program. Also, our forensic program has been reduced by 37%. The only good news at that level is that the crime victims funding remains quite stable. The other issue we've faced in the grants arena is the fact that we have the state-funded programs, which are youth intervention programs, the community crime prevention programs, and the violent crime task forces, were really designed to provide state-supported services around the state. And with declining resources, that has been increasingly difficult to accomplish. And we're just wondering and thinking about, are there different models, are there different ways to approach this statewide funding? The youth services that we do provide are provided by three kinds of services. We have community crime prevention grants. We have the juvenile justice funding, which is supported by the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, and then the youth intervention and prevention projects that you'll be hearing about later. Last but not least is our research and training committee. Our training staff provide an annual conference that is regularly attended by 300 to 400 people, always well evaluated. We have provided training for over 300 crime victim advocates around the state with our Crime Victim Academy, which is a co-sponsored event with St. Cloud. And over 200 folks have attended our other kind of trainings around the state. Our research team has been incredibly busy. producing all kinds of reports. You heard about the Safe Harbors report yesterday. That was facilitated by one of our research teams. They have developed reports and done analysis of disproportionate juvenile disproportionate minority contact and presence in the juvenile justice system. They've done an assessment of the diversion programs around the state. They have a myriad of reports that are on our website, which I really encourage you to take a look at. And if there aren't a significant number of questions, you will be hearing from our dynamic duo, our award-winning research team. Two of the reports have been acknowledged by the National Criminal Justice Association as fine works. I hope you have a chance to hear their presentations, and I'm very happy to answer any questions you may have at this point. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Ms. Bovera, just hopefully when we actually look at the budget that you'll have some printed material. I don't want to have everyone look online for all of the reports, but I think it'd be important for us to know, like, what's federal money, what's
Absolutely.
State money, and so we can, and where the money's getting spent, because, you know, there's always concerns of, is it an equitable geographic split, you know, with resources. Some of the rural areas in Minnesota, as you know, are having a difficult time. Battered women's programs have been cut because of state deficits. So I think we need to see the big picture when we actually look at the budget. So, Representative Mullery, then Cornish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Boyford, you mentioned that you do JJAC funds. I thought that that was a federal program and that they were set up by the feds and they're supposed to make the decisions.
Ms. Boyford.
Mr. Chair. Representative, the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee needs to be under the administration of a state department. We are that agency. JJAC does make the decisions about that funding, but we administer the grants, and the staff that administer those programs are OJP staff.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, you actually did a good job asking that question that I was going to. I would just probably get a little more, if we could, detail. It would just, if we could, the specific grants requests, and then how many were granted. I don't know if there's any data privacy for any of that information. I doubt it, since they're agencies. But just to get right down to detail by line of which, how many came in, where, and then where the grants were requested, that would be great. But otherwise, you did it.
Yeah, we'll get them. So we're struggling with the budget because we don't actually have budget books yet. But Mr. Walz is going to have the dubious distinction of helping put all this together with all of the departments.
Mr. Chair, the original overview actually has funding detail related to it, too, so I'm hoping you still have those to take a look at it. But I will provide whatever detail you need by grant program, whatever is helpful.
Okay, very good. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Boyford, what studies do we have as to the effectiveness of these, whether they're reaching the right populations and things like that? And you don't have to go through all of them right now, but I really would like, before it comes to any kind of funding time, I think it's important to know what studies show which programs are effective, which aren't, and which populations are being reached.
Ms. Boubert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do provide and we promote right from the beginning of our request for proposal, we require that you submit to us the best practices request. Why are you proposing to do what you do? So we're hoping to have research-backed proposals. We also get ongoing reports from all of our grantees reporting their progress. We also monitor them very closely to ensure that they're carrying out the purposes of the grant award and expending dollars appropriately. We also do targeted evaluation, and I hope you're able to hear from one of our staff about the YIP evaluation that was completed over the last several years.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that was my question, too, is how you measure results. These are very good programs, very admirable, but it is a lot of money, and you have to measure results and benchmark this thing. So I'm very interested in seeing some of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Bovera. So who are we hearing from now?
You have the pleasure, Mr. Chair and members, of hearing an overview of the YIP evaluation by Dana Swayze, who's the juvenile research staff person in the Office of Justice Programs.
Mr. Chair?
Sam Cornish.
Mr. Chair, while they're getting ready, I see Mr. Jordahl is up there. I was wondering if we could make sure whenever we have a bill come in front of us, it mentions anything about background checks, we make sure to get the DCA involved in the fiscal note to, or the number of them. And I'm sure they would be, but I don't know if it was mentioned specifically.
Well, yeah, Representative Cornish, that's what I had asked about with Representative Hillstrom's bill, because it dealt with background checks. But they're gonna check into it and see if there is any cost to the BCA.
Yep.
Okay, there it goes. Okay. Ms. Swayze, welcome to the committee. Would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, thank you for your patience during our technical difficulties. My name is Dana Swayze. It's S-W-A-Y-Z-E. I'm an analyst in the Office of Justice Programs, and I focus pretty exclusively on juvenile justice-related issues and youth who are at risk of justice system involvement. And so what I would like to speak to you about today is the Minnesota Youth Intervention Program, also affectionately referred to as YIP or YIP programs. And so I'm going to do a brief overview of those, and then I'm going to talk specifically about a study that was completed by our office regarding the effects of YIP program participation on youth. So this speaks to some of the requests for how do we know that these are good programs to fund and that they're effective in serving youth. We had similar questions and tried to answer those as well. So first of all, a brief overview for those of you who are perhaps unfamiliar. The Minnesota Youth Intervention Program is a collective of individual programs which are supported at least in part by funding set aside by the legislature under statute 299A.73. The YIP program was originally established in 1978, and it's existed in its current language and purpose since 2005. And the statute states that it is the intention of YIP programs to provide an ongoing, stable funding source to community-based early intervention programs for youth. So in order to be eligible for a YIP funding, an individual program must be non-residential and community-based, needs to provide advocacy, education, counseling, mentoring, and referral services to youth and families who are experiencing personal, familial, school, legal, or chemical problems. So a very wide range of issues can present for youth and families, and programs can be eligible to request YIP funding. The current appropriation for 2012-2013 is approximately $3 million. Individual programs receive state YIP funding through a competitive grant process, which is facilitated by our office at OJP. And in 2012, 51 programs across Minnesota were selected to receive YIP funding. And the range of grant awards was a little over $17,000 to $82,000 for a two-year grant period. And programs do have to provide matching dollars that are two times the amount requested in the grant to leverage their own community resources and have a lot of community buy-in to supporting these programs. An additional requirement is that YIP programs must meet at least one, and oftentimes more, of six stated purpose areas. And these are to develop or maintain positive relationships with adults, to decrease illegal activities, to increase positive decision-making skills, increase conflict resolution skills, increase school attendance and achievement, and increase living skills. So some examples of YIP programs that were funded include truancy intervention, mentoring, delinquency diversion, restorative justice and teen courts, community after-school drop-in programs, homeless youth drop-in programs, and also services for youth mental health, family services support, and general positive youth development skills for youth. So that's a sampling of some of the programs that have been funded through YIP. So as you can see, programs funded under YIP provide a broad range of services to youth that range from very early prevention to more later-end intervention, where we're trying to keep youth from going deeper into a justice system. And they also target different purpose areas, and they use a variety of different modalities to deliver their services. So it has historically been rather difficult to comment about the effect of all YIP programs collectively when they do so many different things. So in order to try to address this, in 2009, we at OJP, in collaboration with many YIP programs and also YIPA, their professional organization, came together to design a pre- and post-survey tool for youth that would try to capture and hopefully illustrate that there is a change in attitude and behavior as a result of program participation. So some of the purpose of our study was to identify our YIP programs serving their intended audience that's stated in statute. Do they meet the six stated purpose areas for the program? And are they having a positive effect on youth attitudes and behavior? So I'm going to share with you some of those findings. First, here's a little bit of information about the data collection. Our survey tool, much of it was modeled after the Minnesota Student Survey, which some of you may be familiar with, but it's a very comprehensive survey given every 3 years in public schools. And we did that intentionally so that we could use mainstream Minnesota youth as kind of a quasi-comparison group to look at and compare YIP participants against. Some of the questions were also taken from other risk assessment tools for at-risk populations. So there's kind of a hodgepodge of questions all put together. It's a comprehensive set of questions about youth attitudes and behaviors in school, family, and community domains. There's questions related to their chemical use, emotional health, and contact with law enforcement while they're in the program. So we did 3 years of data collection from January of 2010, and then we wrapped up in August of 2012. We had 48 out of 54 of the YIP-funded programs participated. There were six programs that were exempt from participation, namely because they served youth under 12, which we didn't think were appropriate to take the survey, or they perhaps had issues getting parental consent to participate. Parental consent was needed for all these youth to participate. So we had some exemptions. And overall, when all was said and done, we had over 4,600 pre-surveys and 2,100 post-surveys that were submitted into an online database. If you're familiar, we use the SurveyMonkey data collection tool. It's very easy to use. The kids could take the surveys online, high levels of anonymity to help with honest responses. And so we got a very robust sampling of these kids from as I said, 48 different programs. And then what we did in order to make sure that we had true statistical differences between their pre- and post-attitudes is we needed to match the sample so that we knew that the same kids that took the pre-test were ones taking the post-test. And then we could do a statistical analysis on these youth. So we had over 1,800 pre- and post-matches. So we know that we're looking at the same attitudes of these youth over time. And I hope that's clear. So one of our goals was to find out, do YIP programs serve the intended population of youth? So this is where we compared YIP responses to the Minnesota Student Survey responses, and we chose to compare them against the ninth grade population just because they'd be most comparable in age. And what we found were that YIP participants were more likely to represent communities of color. Over half, 51% of youth in the YIP programs reflected minority communities compared to 27% of ninth graders. Now, part of the reason for that is we do fund some programs that are culturally specific that are intended to serve minority communities, including the American Indian population, the Hmong, Cambodian, and Latino communities. So that's some reason for that number. We found that YIP participants are less likely to report living with both biological or adoptive parents, 38% compared to 61% of mainstream kids, and they're more likely to report living only with their mother, so more evidence of coming from single family systems. YIP participants are more likely to report receiving free and reduced price lunch at school. Over half of YIP participants receive free or reduced price lunch, which is really our only economic indicator on either the YIP survey or the student survey. And then we've also know from data submitted quarterly from our grantees that most of the referrals are coming from schools, the juvenile justice system, and also directly from families. And then we did a comparison of VIP participants who were ages 14 to 16, again, to match up as closely to a ninth grade age population as we could. And we found that VIP participants reported spending fewer hours per week on studying or homework. They were more likely to agree or mostly agree that they feel irritable and angry compared to other ninth grade students. They're more likely to agree or mostly agree that they do things before they think. Over half are saying, yes, I act impulsively, as compared to 42% of ninth graders. So we can see that impulsivity is just a bit of a product of the age group as well. And yet participants were also more likely to report using alcohol and marijuana in the past month compared to mainstream ninth graders. So based on this comparison, we are able to see that the YIP programs are serving and targeting a population of youth that do have some higher risk factors than just your mainstream Minnesota youth population.
Ms. Swayze, one moment. First of all, I would like to welcome the Northview School from Brooklyn Center. They're here to watch our committee. They're part of the Minnesota Historical Society program, Voice of the People. So welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first I'd like to welcome the students from Northview Junior High. I actually went to Northview Junior High. So, Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question, but Representative Lesh wants to comment about the Northview Junior High students.
I want to comment about Northview. I'm a proud Knight. Are you guys still the Knights? All right.
So we both went to Northview.
Absolutely. So, anyway, thanks for being here.
Did you have a question?
I have a real question,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
All right. Thank you. So if you could go back to the statistics that you just gave about how the students respond, can you tell me the question that was asked? Did you ask them, do you feel angry and irritable, and more people said yes? Or did you ask them if they thought they were more irritable than their counter classmates?
Ms. Swayze.
Thank you for the question. They are given a scaling question, so to what extent do you agree with this statement? I am often angry or irritable. And then there's agree, mostly agree, disagree, et cetera. So when we looked at the YIP responses, they were more likely to agree or mostly agree with that question than mainstream youth.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure, because having raised teenagers, I know that teenagers tend to think that their life is worse than everyone else's, or their parents are worse than everyone else's. And so I just wanted to make sure that was the case. Thank you.
Ms. Swayze, please. Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair. Testifier, can you tell me how did you check the reliability of the test itself? In other words, how did you check the verification that the answers were reliable and honest and reliability? Can you?
Ms.
Sure.
Tracy.
Thank you. In speaking to reliability issues, that's actually one of the reasons that we used a lot of Minnesota student survey questions, because that survey has been given for many years now. And so we do know that we have some quality questions there that are getting good answers. So we decided to use those for replication. And then also the vast majority of the other questions that were not involved in the student survey also came from reputable tools that have been used for youth. And in terms of honesty and integrity of their responses, really when we were setting up the system and helping programs understand how to administer these kinds of questions to youth that might potentially incriminate them, if you will, is really made sure to have as many steps regarding confidentiality as we could. One of the ways that we did that was by having it as an online survey. That way there is not, the youth doesn't necessarily have to give something to a staff person or have someone see it, and so there's sort of a little bit more of an inherent confidentiality in that kind of a system. Now, not all programs could administer it electronically, and in that case they did do it on paper, and then we made sure that there was not any staff person that worked directly with the youth who would enter those data, so it was typically more of an administrative staff. So we just tried to do everything we could to make sure that kids to assuage their concerns that anything in the survey might be used against them. And then generally, youth do have a fairly high degree of honesty when you're taking an anonymous survey like this. There's been studies to suggest they are no more dishonest than we are as adults.
Members, I'm going to ask your indulgence a little bit here. Representative Keeper has a question, but we have two programs that want to, Representative Wim, if you Do you have something? Nope. We can try to do it, but we have two programs that want to present to us, and we have to finish her presentation. So, Representative Kiefer, can you just...
Mr. Chair, I'll be really quick, but I am concerned about collecting data, especially given what's going on with the DNR right now, and these are vulnerable young kids. So I just want to make sure that you guys are really protecting them. Thank
and
you.
Representative Uglum, you want to make it?
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. On the 14 to 16-year-olds, what was the percent? Did you have that report for using alcohol or marijuana in the past?
Ms. Swayze.
Sure, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head, but I do believe I have it in the full report, and I can hand that back to a colleague, and she can probably flip through it and find that answer for you.
Just a curiosity on my part, but
okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, Ms. Swayze, can you, I know we're asking you to fast forward this, but I do want to hear from the two programs that are here.
Absolutely. I will try to be brief, and we move into some graphs and visuals, and sometimes that also helps things to move along. And if you're having trouble seeing them up there, then you do have a copy of the PowerPoint in your packet. So really what these graphs are, just to do a brief explanation, is the columns in orange represent youth's responses at the pre-survey when they start the program, and the columns in blue represent their responses at the post-survey when they finish. And I'm presenting findings here that are statistically significant, so we can be quite confident that the change is the result of program involvement as opposed to any sort of random chance. So these do pass a statistical muster, if you will. So at the end of YIP programming, youth participants are statistically more likely to agree or mostly agree with being satisfied with their school attendance and behavior. And you can see on the left that the agreement goes up and the disagreement goes down, so very clear trend. And also that they are more satisfied with their school grades and achievement. And this, again, is one of the six purpose areas to increase school attendance and achievement. So we see some positive results there. At the end of the program, they're asked, since you started the program, how are your assignments and homework, your grades, your attendance, and your school behavior? And you can see on the far left that the largest percentage of youth reported that their grades are a lot better, their attendance and their school behavior is a lot better. And then if you are to add in those who say, yes, it's even a little bit better, you have over half of youth saying that they've had improvement in these areas during their time in the YIP program. You see a very small percentage indicate that their behavior got worse. Some other things that we're looking for are positive decision-making and life skills. So at the end of the program, youth were statistically more likely to agree that they make good decisions and to state agreement that they are good at solving problems. So we have some evidence of some better problem-solving and decision-making and attitudes about their own self-efficacy. Again, with positive decision-making and life skills, there was a statistically significant increase in youth being able to say, yes, I can take a big goal that I have and I can break it down into small steps. There were fewer youth at the end of the program who said that it's hard for them to admit when they've made a mistake or done something wrong. So that ability to take ownership and honesty for their actions and not minimize or justify them. Another goal of the programs is to increase conflict resolution. At the end of the program, there were fewer youth who said, if someone messes with me, I'm going to get them back for it. So we have this we have this reduction in the desire for kind of their quote-unquote justice or retribution, and more, which is indicative of hopefully a better way to solve a problem when they've been wronged or harmed. Also, more youth at the end of program agree that they are able to control their anger than at the beginning of the program. Another goal of the program is to decrease illegal activities. These are the percentage of youth that said while they were in the program, they never had the police bring them home, a new ticket or citation, or a new delinquency charge. And we do give them examples of those so they know what they are. But we have 9 out of 10 participants saying, no, I have not had any illegal activity or police contact since I started the program. This slide shows the level of youth who state that they are chemically abstinent. They did not use before the program, and they still do not use. 70% do not use alcohol and tobacco. Two-thirds, 66%, do not use alcohol. About three-quarters, 74%, do not use marijuana. And nearly 9 out of 10 report they did not use any other drugs, and that includes illegal drugs and also the abuse of like prescription drugs or over-the-counter medications. So we have some significant abstinence rates. And of those youth who do use drugs and alcohol and did acknowledge that on the survey, it was most common for them to say at the end that they use much less drugs or alcohol than before they started the program. Now, I know that we have some individual programs that are wanting to speak as well, but we also looked and did analysis of individual programs who had a sufficient number of surveys, and what we found is that individual programs sometimes were able to really address a risk factor that all programs collectively did not have an effect on. So, for instance, program C on the left, there was a big increase in youth who agreed that they feel good about how their future looks at the end of programming. And on the right, program H, a big reduction in youth saying that they act before they think as a result of participation in program H. So in much the same way that they focus on different areas and different types of youth, individual programs do have effects on certain specific behaviors that they're focusing on. So where did we not see a strong program effect? Collectively and individually, programs were least likely to have a statistical effect on the following areas. In the family domain, there was not a strong suggestion that there was less interpersonal conflict in the family or better rule following in the family system. There was not a significant effect on how youth report feelings, so whether or not they feel angry, whether or not they feel under stress or pressure, whether or not they feel sad or depressed. These programs don't appear to be affecting kind of that core sense of emotional health. And there wasn't as much in the community domain in terms of whether or not they have a job or they participate in community activities or feel safe in their community. And finally, we didn't see a big influence in the peer domain, which is a very sticky thing to get people to make changes in their peers. It's one of the hardest things to do. But they did not have much change in whether or not the people they consider them their friends get in trouble at school, get in trouble with the law, or use drugs or alcohol. So just our conclusions to wrap up, based on a comparison of Minnesota student survey data, YIP funded programs do appear to be serving a population of youth who are generally higher risk. They are contributing to the stated purpose areas. The one purpose area where we did not see much evidence was developing or maintaining positive relationships with adults, and that was not borne out in the survey. YIP participants report numerous statistically significant improvements in beliefs, attitudes, and perceptions, and select programs have success in unique areas that are targeted by their individual programs. The report recommends that we continue to assist programs in collecting data. Though this study is technically done, we are keeping the OJP survey tool open, so programs that wish to continue using this as a data collection tool for their programs can and are continuing to submit surveys. The data do reveal opportunities to expand YIP programs further into programs that serve family, community, and emotional health issues. So there's a whole kind of range that they could push into. And we believe that programs would benefit from ongoing funding to support their quality programming and to serve as many youth as possible in Minnesota. And at the bottom of that slide is a link to the full report, which is posted on our website as well.
I'm going to take two quick questions here, and then we're going to hear from so Representative Schoen and then Representative Mullery, and then we're going to move on.
Mr. Chair, Madam, when I look at your results, one of the things that I've seen in my work life is the osmosis effect on the rest of the family that these programs have too. These kids get involved, and then they bring it home, and the information, and it helps more than just the juvenile that's involved. What I would like to see, if possible, and I think it's hard to do just by having them answer the questions later on in life, is, what's the six-month effect? Because I see your data says at the completion of the program. Mm-hmm. And while they're in the program, I think there's a lot more intense scrutiny about what they're doing. I'd let, at some point, I think it would be nice to see from a financial point, six-month, 12-month, 18-month, if possible. And I don't know if you guys have ever done that, but... And I don't expect you to be able to answer those questions about what those results are, but if that's ever possible, I think it's something worth looking at.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Schoen took my first point. The second point is I don't see anything in here, and I'm not asking a question. I want to get an answer eventually about how these programs affect the persons that are most needy in our state. We have a certain amount of money going into them. I want to make sure, just like Art Rolnick says with early childhood programming, you have to most get at the kids that need it the most. And you can, even if it's involuntary cherry picking, which this may be, you get better results than if you're getting to the kids that need it the most in the state.
Representative Rosenthal, and that's the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to testify, I'm kind of interested in your homeless youth drop-in centers. And are these youth getting other services to transition out of homelessness? And if not, do you provide them with avenues to do so?
Ms. Swayze.
Thank you for your question. The homeless youth drop-in centers definitely try to assist youth with a wide variety of services and reunification, if that's a goal, or even just helping with basic needs. So they're pretty comprehensive programs. May I respond to a comment as well? In terms of wanting to provide services to youth who have the greatest needs, that is true. You do want to give the highest risk and greatest need youth the most services. But the risk responsivity principle also suggests that lower risk and lower need youth do need interventions. They just need a lower level. So in some ways, part of what I was looking at to make sure that these programs are targeting the appropriate youth is I did not see a lot of youth respond to the survey that said that they had real extreme delinquency issues, real extreme chemical issues, really extreme school issues. And in a way that is good, not only because we don't want them to have those problems, but those youth probably would not be an appropriate fit for an intervention, a youth intervention program such as this. Those are the youth who are probably going to be served perhaps by a community probation level or things like that. So it's making sure that you are assigning the right intervention for the risk level that the youth have. And these youth, hopefully, will be lower to moderate risk youth as opposed to our moderate to high risk youth that are perhaps going to need the intervention of social services or juvenile justice or et cetera.
So, Ms. Swayze, we'll have you back when we get into the budgets of the OJP later. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Who's up first here? Is this Amicus? Sorry for the limited amount of time. We can just have you present for and leave a little time for some questions. If you can do this in maybe 10 minutes, that would be great.
Yep.
Okay. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Steve Nelson. I'm the Director of Communication and Evaluation for Amicus. And
my name is Maya Peisel, and I'm the Katahdin Fellow at Amicus. I work in the RADIUS program for girls.
Okay.
In Minnesota, an estimated 15,000 girls are arrested each year. That's less than boys, but it's growing more quickly. And about 44% of Minnesota's out-of-home population is comprised of girls who are in out-of-home placement. Looking at those figures, Amicus RADIUS was established in the year 2000, and we work with girls ages 12 to 18. Who have been involved with delinquent behavior, getting involved with the juvenile justice system. And what we found is that they have very different needs than boys. They're more motivated by relationships, both good and bad, and they're also more likely to have experienced some form of abuse. We started out working with state commit girls through the DOC back in the late 90s and early 2000, and spent several years working with the Ramsey County Juvenile Justice System, and currently our work is focused on girls in the Hennepin County Juvenile Probation System. We work with about 90 girls a year that are referred to us through Hennepin County Juvenile Probation. We work in three different regions, North Minneapolis, South Minneapolis, and suburban Hennepin County. I'll have Maya tell you a little bit more about the program.
Hello. So like Steve said, RADIUS is a 14-week program for girls on probation in Hennepin County. And our mission is to model safe and supportive relationships within a comprehensive strength-based program so that girls can create their own healthy relationships, make positive decisions, and ultimately, we hope, become the architects of their own success. The girls who we work with are strong and hilarious, usually very kind and giving, but they've also been through a lot, and there's a lot of chaos in their life, usually created by adults and created by systems. Most of our girls are young women of color living in poverty, and they've interacted with a lot of people who have told them that there's not much that they can do. So our goal is to show the girls what we see in them and all the power they have to create the kind of life that they want to live. So we have three different components. First, all the girls complete at least 10 individual counseling sessions with a counselor in their region. And then also we have a weekly group with 9 or 10 girls. We cover topics like healthy romantic relationships, healthy family relationships, sexual health, restorative justice. And then also we try to link the girls up with resources, and we hold circles of support following a restorative justice model where the girl and people who are most important in her life come together to address a struggle or a challenge or to celebrate something positive going on. And the outcomes that we hope for and usually see are, first, that a girl find her own sense of safety. Sometimes that means purging relationships that are really toxic or working on those relationships. Sometimes it means developing a safety plan. And a lot of times it means finding a sense of calm and control within yourself so that you can navigate all the crazy stuff that's going on in your life. And then another really important thing is creating healthy relationships inside of their own lives. And that how we do that is kind of two prongs. First, you have to have a vision for what a relationship can look like and the responsibility that each person has to affect a relationship and the positive things that can come out of that, as opposed to all of this negative. And then also we have we help the girls learn the skills that they need, like self-regulation, conflict resolution, breathing, communication, things that sometimes you really want to make a good choice but you're not quite sure how, and you feel those things rising up in you and you're not sure what to do about it. So learning the skills to do that is really important. And finally, we facilitate the girls seizing their own power to create the lives that they want to live. In a big sense, the vision, the possibilities are endless. These girls can do anything. Hardly anybody has told them that. And on a smaller sense, breaking down goals into manageable pieces, like going to school, showing up to school every day and not getting in a fight one day. Okay, take it one day at a time. Or going to college or getting a job. Really manageable goals, but also as part of a broader vision for their future. And underneath all of that, our approach is really focused on trauma and healing, and seeing that we come from a place that each girl is a whole person already, but recognizing that there's a lot of pain that's like a roadblock, a giant barrier that people have to work through. And so every time somebody says something to you, there's another little voice in the back of your head that's mimicking back trauma that's not going necessarily going on anymore. And so we try to work with girls to shut down that part so that they can respond to what's going on right now in the present in the way that they can. And yeah, I think Radius is a really awesome program. And if you have any questions about it, I would love to answer them.
Can you explain again how girls get referred into the program?
Yeah, all the girls are on probation, and they're often court ordered in directly into Radius, or maybe referred by their probation officer if Radius is a good fit for them.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, we've recently done some focus groups with Hennepin County Juvenile Probation, as well as parents and participants in Radius. And what Hennepin County Juvenile Probation has told us is that Radius is the only program in Hennepin County that currently meets many of the gender-specific needs of the girls. They feel that the work of Radius program and its staff is critical. What we've seen over the last 3 years with Radius is of the girls who have completed our program between December 2008 and October 2011, 78% were not adjudicated for a new violation, and 95% of those who completed our program have stayed out-of-home placement. So those are two big success indicators that we pay a lot of attention to. In addition to that, we're working with Wilder Research right now on a project that's funded through the OJJDP. And we're doing a three-year comprehensive evaluation project of Radius. We know we've got a good program. We're trying to make sure that we have the best program that we can possibly get. We're looking at it quantitatively. We'll be comparing outcomes such as rearrests, reconvictions, and out-of-home placements for program participants with an historical comparison group. We're actually working with Hennepin County to de-identify a group of girls who would have been involved in Radius if Radius were available to them at that point. And we'll be comparing the success rates of our girls with those girls. And also we'll be working collaboratively with Hennepin County to gather and analyze the data and even do an ROI, basically return on investment for the amount of money that we're spending on Radius to help inform policy discussions. This isn't just for us. We're hoping to identify some of these things to do a better job of identifying them as a model for national groups throughout the country. Not that much is known about working with girls in the juvenile justice system, and we're hoping to at least add to some of that.
And did you say so you're only dealing with girls in Hennepin County?
At this point, that's where we have our contract with Hennepin County. Approximately 60% of the Radius budget is funded through Hennepin County. I'd say about 20% is funded through YIP and a grant, and another 20% is funded by private donations.
So maybe when we dig into this a little deeper, we can find out what other YIP programs that are specifically dealing with girls being court-ordered from probation. What other programs are available in the metro and greater Minnesota? I don't know where we can. Ms. Bovera, did she leave already? Are there other programs, or is this it? Okay. Well, maybe we can get that information also. Any questions? Very good. Thank you for your presentation. And now we have someone from Headway Emotional Health.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Committee, and thanks for allowing us time to speak. I'm the Director of Client Services from Headway Emotional Health Services. We're a nonprofit organization with our administrative offices in Richfield.
And for the record, you're Hal Pickett.
Hal Pickett, okay. P-I-C-K-E-T-T. Okay. Sorry. I'm going to speak this morning on two of our programs that have received monies from Youth Intervention that are both diversion programs. Our first program that I'm going to talk about is our Truancy Case Management, which is a truancy diversion program in Hennepin County, and we are only one of the Hennepin County providers. We are providing services in the southern and western suburbs for K through 12. So in our truancy case management program, students are referred through the school system and through the county attorney's office. We first engage children who are at risk for being truant. If they do not voluntarily get involved in our program and they continue to be truant, then there's a stronger recommendation for them to get involved in our program when they come to a student team attendance review board. It's still a voluntary program. The families can still choose to go into truancy court. In the last academic year, we received referrals from 704 students in the southern and western suburbs, and with those students, we do individual school meetings with the child. We do family meetings in the home. We do meetings with any of the school staff and on an as-needed basis. We also provide referrals to mental health, chemical health, trauma assessments. All of our programs at Headway are trauma-informed, so we are always looking at the understanding the sequelae of social, psychological, neurological problems that go along with developmental trauma. In the last academic year in our case management program, we were able to show an increase in attendance in school from a baseline of 79% to an improvement to 91%. We are using an evidence-based model called Check and Connect and addressing one of the issues that Representative Mullery brought up. We are now involved in a research project with, I'm going to read the name of them because I never remember, the University of Minnesota Urban Research and Outreach Engagement Center, and we are looking at an intensity of service model. So what we're doing is a research project that involves step treatment, so everyone gets the baseline treatment. For those that don't respond to the baseline treatment, they go to a more intense treatment. So the overall goal is to identify, can we identify those factors and those risk factors that tell us what intensity we need to start with so that the children who need the least amount of services are getting the least amount of service and the children who need more intense service are getting more intense services. The second program I'm going to talk about is our pre-charge youth diversion program. We are the contracted screener for pre-charge diversion in Hennepin County again. With those, we see youth that have committed a petty misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor it is decided by the county attorney's office that the crime is nonviolent, first-time offender, and that they are offered diversion services to prevent them from going into to official charging and in the court system. In that program, we received last year was our first year with that program, so we were doing 11 months. We had 901 referrals. Out of those 901 referrals, we were able to get diversion contracts signed with 81% of those kids. A diversion contract is a contract with the youth and the parent that says they're going to commit no more crime, they're going to have no more excused absences from school, they're going to pay restitution, and they're going to participate in some kind of diversion programming. That diversion programming can be anywhere from public service to going into a six-month sexual boundaries education program. In that program, we are only paid by Hennepin County to do the screening, so there is no monies within the county to do the treatment. We are coupled with seven other community partners that we refer to, as well as we have three diversion programs within our organization. One is a shoplifter's report. We have three diversion programs within our organization. One is a shoplifter's program. Our shoplifter's program is based on a cognitive behavioral model, psychoeducation, and a restorative justice model with mindfulness training. That is a parent and child required attendance model. So we do a lot of psychoeducation with the parent around the legal system, and the children or the youth do a lot of programming around restorative justice. In that program, we do pre-post treatment outcome measures, and we've been able to show, and this is only a six-hour treatment program, we've been able to show a 5% improvement in adjustment scores and a 6% improvement in self-esteem scores in that particular treatment model. We also do a diversion anger management program for youth that have had mostly fifth-degree assault charges. In that situation, we are again providing 6 hours of anger management programming that's based on the anger replacement model, which is a nationally evidence-based recognized model. In that program, it is not a parent-involved program, so those are individual cases. In that situation, we're doing pre-post measures with an anger screening tool. With kids that are rated as clinically significantly elevated on that tool, we've been able to show a 10% improvement in reactive anger, and we've been able to show 11% improvement in anger coping skills. Our third program that we have in our diversion program is our sexual boundaries program, and that is actually a six-month psychoeducational mindfulness, sex education, and empathy training program that is actually connected with our outpatient sex offender treatment program. The recidivism data that we have on that is very difficult to get, but the recidivism data shows less than a 1% recidivism in those kids for acting out again in a sexual manner that have successfully completed that program. So with, I'm going to be quick and close. Beyond all of that, one of the things that I want to say is that I'm a mental health professional, and with these programs, we are touching 1,400 plus kids a year, metaphorically, that would never show up in my office, or at least not show up till they're much further down the road, or maybe not at all because they're in in juvenile justice or even in prison. So we do have an opportunity with these youth intervention programs to really do some early intervention and maybe even some prevention work to kind of impede this trajectory that looks like these kids are taking, because we're getting them at the front door. So thank you for allowing me to present today, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, so just to be clear, so your referrals, Mr. Pickett, are coming from the school district as well as from county probation?
Yes.
Okay. And the fifth degree charges, are they, what are the bulk of those? Are those dating violence that go into anger management, or are those fights that students are getting into? Or?
Well, actually, it's interesting because we talk about school attendance and truancy, and about 75% of those fifth-degree assaults are actually happening at school. So they're school fights between peers, mostly.
I see. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Pickett,
for
coming down and presenting. Ms. Bovera, do you think we've only got 10 minutes? Should we give this some other time so we can do this? And I think that's probably a good idea.
Sure.
So I apologize to the research director who was going to present. So we'll do it at a different time so we can give you more opportunity. So members, is there anyone who wants to testify before the Committee on Youth Intervention Programs? Thank you for your presentations. Thank you, members. We'll see you tomorrow. Meeting's adjourned.